So, I just want to introduce a topic, a couple of topics on the agenda today. You can see the full roster of investment topics. First up is going to be Mike Dell, who is talking about their tentative forecast of returns and risks of all the major asset classes that have been met. First Eagle discussing risks and opportunities in the marketplace. I have no idea what they're going to talk about in terms of risks. But it's an interesting time to come together and discuss these topics. We had incredibly strong 2019 equity markets, of course, the indices up 20-30%. I think January, last week, has been less. We've certainly seen steady valuations. It's the market going into a shock, and that's what we're seeing right now. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how much of this is going to be. I will just before we move to presentations, recall that we are long term investors. We tend to be 5 to 15 year outlook. And I think it's going to be interesting to know what is going to be how Ferris goes about building up expectations over that part of the long time period. How valuations factor into that. I think we're looking at the trustees, what the direction of those expectations has been for the past couple of years. So with that,
good morning, everyone. I'm excited to be here. I'm going to try to keep my comments relatively brief. Obviously, the fact that we're all very engaged and probably have some questions along the way, which I welcome. I want to start at a very high level, as Tim kind of did, and start with the golden rule of pensions, as your actuary would call it, which is that contributions plus investments equals benefits plus expenses. Over time, that obviously has to hold true for the system to be solvable. The asset liability study component is really where we spend a concerted amount of time and effort to try to get that investments piece of the puzzle right. And by right, I don't mean maximizing return. I mean taking the right amount of risk and balancing risk and return relative to the ecosystem. So that's a process that is ongoing, and we'll be spending more time over the next several months on that process. When you talk about that process, though, getting that investment piece of the puzzle right, that really starts with asset allocation. Asset allocation is going to drive about 90 to 95% of the variation returns through time. It's the implementation job that Tim and his team are responsible for is around the edges to optimize that asset allocation or to improve outcomes relative to that strategic policy that we want to set. So when you talk about optimizing but finding that right asset allocation, you're really trying to find which pieces of the puzzle you want and how big you want those pieces to be. And so to do that, you need to know what those pieces of the puzzle look like. And that's what we call calibrated assumptions. So this is forecast for expected return, how much do we expect different asset classes to compound at, expected risk, which we normally quantify as standard deviation, how variable are those returns through time, and then correlation, which is how do those assets move in relation to one another through time. And we have to make assumptions about each of those three variables for every asset class. So this is no easy task because we're dealing in uncertainties, we try to approach this exercise first and foremost with humility because we recognize we don't have a crystal ball for the future. We try to be as objective as we can in factors and different drivers of return and look at where those are at, how those different factors have influenced asset classes historically, and what that might tell us about the future. So, with that as a foundation, there's another golden rule that is in the finance world, and it's born of the efficient market hypothesis, or really capital market theory in general, and it's shown on page 3. And this is a little bit of a teaser of kind of where we'll get to later, which is what we're forecasting your current strategic long-term asset allocation is to 6.5%. That's based off our 2020 capital market assumptions. What's driving that, you can really think about it as there's three different things. There's the risk-free rate, which is kind of the cash rate. There's not a lot you can do to influence that. You're kind of a condition taker. So what the risk-free rate is, it's influenced by the Federal Reserve and some other factors. Where we're spending most of our time for the asset liability study is this middle box, beta. And what beta is really a fancy word for kind of the market risk rate. That's the premium that we earn for taking market risk. So we're going to spend the bulk of the asset liability study refining how we want to do that, which is there's really two components. There's how much risk do we want to be taking? That's that absolute risk. And then there's the Sharpe ratio, which is a fancy way of saying how efficiently are we capturing risk and converting it into return. The third component is alpha, which is important to keep in mind. We're not trying to forecast alpha in this exercise. Tim and his team and us, we spend a great deal of time trying to identify managers that can generate alpha, as well as alpha that can come from perhaps being underweight or overweight relative to your policy mix. But that's really a separate discussion, so it's important to keep that in mind. What's in a forecast? There's a couple things I want to leave you with here. The first and foremost is we talk a lot about point estimates, and we do that because there's not a great alternative to talking about point estimates, but this is not a precise exercise. I think if we can get within 0.5% over 10 years of what actually happens, then we can probably call that one. Markets are very difficult to predict, but we look out 10 years because we think that that's a long enough time horizon that valuations and fundamentals, whether it be interest rates or price to earnings ratios, those should have some impact on what the growth rate is. It's long enough that it kind of ignores the noise, but it's short enough that the starting valuations matter. So when we talk about those variables, we said there's an expected return component. That's the median. That's where this, to go back to your high school days, where that bell curve peaks. Obviously, the further to the right that it peaks, and then that peak is the median outcome, the better. And then the standard deviation is how wide this distribution is. The classic or the mathematical is plus or minus one standard deviation is about 68%, call it 2/3. Plus or minus two standard deviations is 95%. So a great deal of your observations should fall within two standard deviations. When you go out three standard deviations, you're supposed to capture 99.7% if the data set behaves normally. What we've found in history is that in reality, asset class returns and markets don't have a normal distribution. And what that means is those tail characteristics, they tend to occur a little more frequently than normal distribution would suggest. So that's, when we think about tail risk, we use a distribution that in a standard deviation to try to quantify it, but we recognize that that's not a perfect science either. And so we address that through several other tools that we'll get into later in the
Scott?
I
had a question. I don't know if it's for Mike or Tim, but in the context of in the topic that we're currently in, guess I'm looking for some context about what an asset liability study scope is. Is everything on the table, or are we talking about it in the context of the fully functional portfolio?
So this is only a 5-year study. We're actually re-examining the liability profile versus the process of agreement, right? Expected liabilities that match with every asset classes. So this is the 5-year study. This is not the every year of the fine tuning. This is just the re-examining the degree of lots of weights for the FFP model. It's 4 years, so right? For smaller amounts there, we take the data wider range of potential
within that structure.
Primarily within that structure, the trustee might consider another structure. That going forward basis is portfolio construction processes and established overlay asset processes.
Okay, that's really what I wanted to get to. I wasn't sure what how broad.
Yes,
chart.
Within that structure, we're going to examine four options that we do want to hear. So that's why we're going to emphasis on this one, which is that there are four options for the investment.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. Appreciate it.
So how do we go about generating these forecasts? Well, at a very high level, we use what's called a building block methodology, which is just as it sounds. You kind of disaggregate the different components that should be leading to your total return for your different asset classes. This is kind of the best option we have available, and this is the most commonly used way that we try to generate expectations. The alternative would be to simply extrapolate historical returns forward, which lacks academic rigor, and it's probably not a fair way of approaching. So I'm going to take you through briefly kind of how this building block approach works for fixed income and equity, because that's the most straightforward way of understanding this. Starting with fixed income, that's the most straightforward because the data shows us that the starting yield is a very strong indicator of what the future returns are going to be in fixed income. If you take a simple example of a 10-year treasury and roll it to maturity, you're going to realize your starting yield must be worse than the expected yield. By and large, you're going to earn that starting yield on your fixed income. Now, when you move out fixed income and you start talking about different things like credit, you're taking on different risk factors. And so what we're showing here on this page is there's a separate building block for there's a treasury yield component and then there's a credit spread component. So for a core portfolio of very high-quality bonds, a good chunk of return is coming from that treasury component, and you're not taking a lot of credit risk. So that's the, you move from kind of 1.7 to 2.2. At the extreme, you can see when you move to high yield, these are lower credit quality companies, and there's no assurance that they're going to be a going concern forever. Stated differently, there's some risk that these companies will make for it. And so there's a market implied, the price or the yield of the security has a credit spread to address that risk of them defaulting. And that's the credit spread. What we have to keep in mind for these types of securities is there's also some expectation of some of these companies defaulting. And so you have to reduce your expectation by that. And so that's how we get to a 3.3% for a bank. Moving to equity, we try to approach it with the same mindset, even though there's a little bit less predictive power associated with things like dividend yield. So to look at just on the left side of the page, large cap, we have 5.5% return expectation for the next 10 years. What's driving that is there's a 2% dividend yield historically, and we expect that to continue. There's a real earnings growth component, which is 2.1%, and then there's an inflation component to get a nominal return. There's also a repricing component because you have to remember the stocks are influenced that's the valuation change component. For U.S. large stocks, when we did this analysis, the Shiller price earnings, or the normalized price earnings, was in the 81st percentile relative to its history. So it was, stocks were a little bit more expensive in the U.S. relative to internationally. And so we build in a 0.5% haircut to address the likelihood that over time stocks international developed, you can see that rather than that being the haircut, it's additive to returns. And that's because when we ran this analysis, international developed stocks were in the 34th percentile of their history, so they were cheaper than the average. So that added 0.5% to returns. Page 8, I won't belabor. This is all of the detailed assumptions for every asset class. Thing I will point out is the global equity number, which, you know, takes the large, takes the international, takes the emerging markets, etc. That's 6.4%. That's lower than what markets have generated over the last 10 years, and lower than your return assumption. And so that, when that's the more risky component of your portfolio, you know, albeit you have some private equity, which is a little more risky, it's hard to make the math work on. What used to be a very common 7.5-8% return, because bonds are clearly less than stocks, and so the math just doesn't get there. So, as you're all likely very familiar, it's a very challenging time to be investing. You're in an era of low starting interest rates and high valuations. It makes it challenging. Jake?
Yeah, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but on that slide for the numbers.
Yep.
It's easy to. I guess you can notice that the Sharpe ratio forecasts are, by and large, much lower than the historical Sharpe. Is that a result of, is that a return forecast or a vol forecast, or is that some combination?
We're not forecasting a Sharpe ratio. It's a calculation coming from the return and the risk forecast.
Yeah, so which input is driving that?
Both, let's say. So our return expectations are lower than they've been for the past 10 years, lower than what realized returns have been for the past 10 years, so the numerator of that ratio is smaller. The denominator, so our forecast for volatilities, is higher than what the last 10 years have been. I think we characterize the last 10 years, this week being the exception, as low average volatility with a few notable exceptions. That was the great financial crisis. That was a very volatile period. There's periods like the taper tantrum, which is a classic very volatile. But by and large, the realized volatilities have been lower for the past 10 years.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
This is another way of driving home that concept that we're dealing in uncertainties, and that while we talk a lot about point estimates, you have to keep in mind that we're really talking about ranges for each of these asset classes. The other thing that I'll mention that might be obvious is risk and return are generally expected to be related, which is to say that as you take more risk, you expect the median probably to be higher. You're being compensated over time by bearing the volatility. But that doesn't always hold true. That's not a guarantee. Because if we knew that we could get the median return, we would just hold up the private equity and global equity flow of the day. But you have to keep in mind, kind of, if there was a worst case scenario and we were at the bottom of these distributions, then your best asset class is cash. It might be obvious, but you always have to keep in mind that just because the point estimate, the median is higher, it's no finish.
Correlations.
Yes, please.
Scott? Quick question on the last graphic. This may be a dumb question, but how is short-term credit considered less volatile than cash?
I don't know. I don't know that it's less volatile, because that wouldn't make much sense.
Yeah, it's to the right of
it
cash
is to the right
on
the graph.
Declining.
So we've got a short-term
You got short-term government in front of that.
Right. I think that's just a... I don't know why it's visually that way. It's our standard deviations are higher for short-term credit than they are for cash.
I would think.
Yeah.
I did. You know. Yeah. I didn't know. Okay.
So the third piece of the puzzle, we've talked about volatility and, you know, a measure of the range of outcomes. We've talked about the median or the expected return. Correlations are how assets move relative to one another. When you have a correlation of one, and this measure ranges from one to negative one, when you have a correlation measure of one, that means that assets move in perfect unison. So there's no diversification benefit. You'd be agnostic between one or the other if they had the same expected return. What we want in through this asset allocation exercise is assets that have a lower correlation to one another. A correlation of negative one means the assets behave as perfect opposites. It doesn't tend to really exist, but it's in financial theory, it could exist. A correlation of zero means that the behavior of one asset class has no bearing on the behavior of the other asset class. In practice, kind of anything below a 0.4 correlation is good. And I think historically, treasuries and cash have had, or I'm sorry, treasuries and equities have had, you know, negative correlations through time for most of history, but sometimes positive correlations. I think our assumption is 0.2 for global stocks and core bonds. The other point there is correlations are not static over time, and that makes this all the more challenging. When we talked about, there was a common expression in the Great Financial Crisis, correlations went to one, which means all asset classes lost money at the same time. You try to diversify as best you can by finding these asset classes that have low correlation to one another, but you recognize that, like everything else in investing, there's no guarantees. So this is all of the correlation assumptions that will go into your study. I won't read each of them for you. How does this all come together? So what I'm showing here is what's called an efficient frontier. And this is a range of different options, starting with, and I've simplified this by just using a two asset class portfolio. So just a global stock portfolio and a core plus bond portfolio. So kind of those traditional anchors to a portfolio. Obviously, you'd want to be up and to the left as much as possible. That would be ideal because that would mean you're getting more return and less risk. What an efficient frontier is trying to show you is the range of different portfolio mixes that are possible based off your assumptions and based off the asset classes you're using. And the key takeaway here is you see that blue line, it kind of pulls up into the left, and that's that diversification benefit. If you took a simple average of just our assumptions for stocks and our assumptions for bonds, and you weighted them, you would move along that dotted line. But the diversification benefit, because there's some reduction in volatility associated with having asset classes that don't move in lockstep, you're able to generate a portfolio that would perform better than the sum of its parts, so to speak. Moving to the next page, what we're showing here is subtracting our current forecast from what our forecasts were last year, and by and large we're using the same methodology for each of these asset classes, and so this is really an apples to apples comparison. What you'll see is most of these numbers are negative, which is to say that our return expectations have come down significantly from last year. And the reason for that is we had a really remarkable year. As Tim pointed out, stocks were up between 20 and 30%. You know, high yield was up, you know, 10%. Those were much stronger returns than we were expecting to start the year. So in a sense, you're pulling forward future returns and borrowing from the future into the present. But we were invested last year, so we reaped the benefit of those strong markets. And so what I'm trying to show here is that yes, our forecast is lower than it was last year, but that's in a way okay because we did benefit from last year. And we talk about a 10-year horizon, but we have to remember that the pension doesn't operate on a 10-year horizon. It, in theory, at least, should operate in perpetuity. And so, you know, time is really a continuum, and we have to be mindful of that. So what I'm showing on the bottom of 14, I went back and ran the asset allocation with the 2019 assumptions, and what that generated was a forecast of 7.1% over 10 years. The realized return, as Eileen will cover in performance, was 14.6%, quite a bit better than our 7% compound rate. So if you do the math on that and you say, what do I need to earn for years 2 through 10 for that 7.1 number to be correct? Well, it would be 6.25, which is to say that if you amortize that extra return above 7.1%, spread it over the other 9 years, you need to earn less in the remaining years to make that initial forecast correct. Well, fast forward 1 year, and our current assumption is 6.5%. And so we think we can still do a little bit better than that 6.25, but obviously, you know, quite a bit lower than the 7.1 that we went into last year with the forecast of. So that's kind of how it all comes together. Hopefully,
Mike, yes. If I could, while you're on that, if we go back a year, we had a negative 2%. So on a 7% assumption, that's a negative 9. Okay, this year we're ahead by 7.6. So on the sum of the 2 years, obviously each is amortized out over a smoothing period, the sum of the two is reasonably equivalent. So we don't have the benefit of that. I guess I just want you to comment still on the validity of our 7% assumption against a 6.5% expectation.
So you're absolutely right. You can look at this slice and dice this any number of ways, and you know, you could look at it over 10 years and say, well, we've realized something higher over those years. That's the challenge of this exercise, is the time horizon is what you choose that it's going to be for purposes of our analysis. This plan is going to, you know, when your actuary is discounting your future liabilities, they're using a 30 plus 50 year, you know, sort of time horizon. So I don't think that your goal through this exercise should be to try to tie that, you know, median forecast return directly to your return assumption, because there's so much, not subjectivity, but uncertainty associated with each of the inputs in this exercise, and the time period that you're looking at for your liabilities may not align with our forecast time period. Does that somewhat answer your question?
Well, my goal wasn't to put you on the spot with a precise answer, but broadly, we as a board, among the most important considerations we have to debate and consider is that underlying assumption. During the period I've been on the board, we've seen it drop from 7.75 to 7. We will at least be considering whether or not to go further down.
Right.
This is absolutely basic, it seems to me, to that consideration. I just wanted your input.
Yes, it's in some sense a chicken or the egg exercise, but they have to rhyme. And directionally, returns assumptions have been coming down for years now, and your system is no exception. I don't think I've ever gone through an asset liability study where that hasn't been hotly debated by the board as part of this process, because intuitively, in your mind, you want those numbers to tie. And in reality, I just don't think it's that simple.
Well, I think intuitively you'd like to see the projected return higher.
Sure.
For a cushion, obviously.
Sure.
That where it's lower, should we be considering a reduction? I think at 7, we are now 50-50. That is, the 20 37 ag plans, I think 10 are at 7, and I believe 9 are at 6 and 3 quarters and 1 6 and a half, something like that. So we have gone from being out in front is lower, to now being at best in sort of the middle of the pack.
Sure. And John, just another data point there. The 2019 capital market assumptions were set after 2018 was already in the books, right? We had a negative year in 2018, equity markets were off, therefore forward assumptions bumped up. So to follow your exercise through, if we were to take a look at Verisk's capital market assumptions for the 2018 cycle, the number was roughly 6.5% at that point in time. So I think that forward assumption went up when the markets were down and reversed here. So probably over that two-year period, gotten back to roughly the same spot in terms of a forward-looking expectation.
So later on in the year, the discussion is going to center around, well, can we rejigger this pie and slice the pieces differently to more optimally capture market risk, and do we want to target more risk to align with that 7% hurdle, and how can we do that, or are we comfortable with the current amount of risk, or do we want to take less risk? And typically that discussion about taking less risk goes hand in hand with, well, can we afford to bring the discount rate down a little bit? We won't get into that quite yet. This was really meant to be the kind of the table setting. I think that does it for me, unless there's any other questions.
Any other questions? I see one. Jake?
Yeah, just a quick one. I appreciate you bringing the updated CMAs to the board. I was wondering if you were able, maybe the next time you show up, to provide some context around CMAs from other providers.
Sure.
Not necessarily consultants, but perhaps asset managers if they have their own on different timescales too, that would be great.
Sure. We can certainly do that. I know JP Morgan publishes every year, several other firms.
Yeah.
We tend to be around the middle. Some will be more optimistic than others, but they tend to even out. But I'm happy to do that.
And you also noted that in the beginning, kind of as a comment, that if we ended up within 0.5% of the forecast at the end of the horizon, not that anyone else is going to be here, but if we ended up within 0.5%, that would be a win.
For an individual asset class.
Okay. For an individual asset
class. So for large cap stocks, for instance, but we might be more rosy on one asset class relative to another, or more optimistic relative to another, but I would hope that the total portfolio expected return, with those pluses and minuses offsetting, we're at least a little closer than 0.5%.
Yeah, so how long has Verisk been producing CMAs?
Well, we've been around 30 years, and I would guess that for at least 20 of those, we've been producing CMAs.
And so maybe the next time also, in addition to CMAs from other providers, it would be nice to see kind of the accuracy over those forecasts, how that's panned out.
Sure. It's a humbling review, but I'm happy.
Yeah, I mean, we put a lot of stock into the numbers, right? The last time we were discussing the experience and talking about adjusting the discount rate, we had a range of forecasts, and the kind of range of forecasts was pretty broad. So I think one of the comments at the time was that it is one number that we're looking at, but the range around that is broad. And so when we're setting something like a discount rate, it's very limited kind of accuracy that we're looking at. So there's a lot of judgment to that expectation setting.
Anything else from Mike? Seeing none.
Thank you
very much.
Very much.
Okay,